Maybe we're all getting a little carried away with this. Admittedly, a few birds did act strange, but that's no reason to...
I keep telling you, this isn't a few birds. These are gulls, crows, swifts.
I have never known birds of different species to flock together. The very concept is unimaginable. Why, if that happened, we wouldn't stand a chance. How could we possibly hope to fight them?
Today on Real Lit, another great discussion is about to take flight.
Welcome to Real Lit, a semi-academic look into works of literature and their adaptation into film. I'm Mackenzie.
And I'm Steven. And oddly enough, I think I heard another voice on the teaser. That was strange.
Hmm.
Oh, hey, there's someone else in the studio. How did you get here?
He's joking, of course. This is a very special episode of Real Lit as we're entertaining our first guest. So all of our loyal listeners out there, please join me in welcoming our friend and colleague, Brenna.
Yay.
Yay. Hello, everyone.
Brenna's an associate professor of English and film studies who received her PhD in literature at the University of Oregon. She's published numerous essays and articles in the field, including, and quite relevant today, The Murder in the Garden, Something Rotten in Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy. And I believe you have a couple of other publications on Hitchcock as well. Also, I just have to throw this out here, her book of essays and poems entitled Of Moose and Me, Animal Tales from an Alaskan Childhood. It's excellent. Beautifully written, understated sense of humor. Run to Amazon right now. Check it out.
And Brenna has done a lot of work with Hitchcock as well as the Hollywood Renaissance. She's currently working on a monograph about costuming in film. So I'm sure she'll have something to say about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Definitely that fabulous green dress.
Oh, yes. I love that dress. There's a lot to say about Tippi Hedren's costumes and, of course, the great Edith Head, who designed it. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about Hitchcock and the birds. This isn't, I have to say, one of my favorite Hitchcock films, although it is up there in one of the, I think, most experimental and interesting of the Hitchcock films. I was drawn to Hitchcock films from a young age, actually traumatized by Hitchcock as a young person because when I was a little girl, I wasn't allowed to watch television late at night. That was my mother's thing when she got all of us to bed. And one night I snuck out when I was not supposed to be out and I saw the attempted murder scene in Dial M for Murder.
Oh.
And all I saw was, spoiler alert, Grace Kelly's character killing her assailant with a pair of scissors. And that traumatized me for years and years and years. And then when my mom and dad got a VHS player, yes, I am also that old, one of the first things we watched was Dial M for Murder. And finally, I could actually put that scene in context. And even though I'm still traumatized, perhaps less so now, thanks to that. But a longtime Hitchcock fan, I've worked, as Stephen mentioned, on Frenzy, currently working on Rear Window for my book on film costume, the poetry costume.
Jimmy Stewart.
Yes, Grace Kelly. In fact, I'm working with Grace Kelly's green suit, which is a predecessor in some ways to the green suit that we see in The Birds. It's that same color, which is eau de Nil, which means water of the Nile. And it's a wonderful kind of light green color that reflects an interest in Egypt and sort of the aesthetics of Egypt in late 19th, early 20th century. So
I definitely wanted it.
Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And of course, Edith Head, really famous costume designer, and also a designer in her own right beyond the film world. And she was known as the dress doctor for her ideas about how to dress better for just everyday people. So, yay, Edith. We could all use some of that. I could use that help.
And we should mention we have a beautiful Barbie doll of Melanie Daniels.
Yes.
That Brenna nicely supplied us. And we'll have a picture of that on the Facebook page. And
yes.
We'll put it up on the website on this episode as well.
This is the black label Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds Barbie, which was done in connection, I believe, with the 45th anniversary of The Birds. And it shows our main character of Melanie Daniels, played by Tippi Hedren, in the famous eau de Nil suit, being attacked. Spoiler alert, by birds.
No phone booth, though. Although that,
no,
that
no.
Packaging is very similar.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I called it a mint green dress, and Mackenzie quickly corrected me and told me that was sage green. But
And we were both wrong.
We were both wrong. Well, I guess we'll start out with our segments. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. And we knew we were going to talk about some costuming with you.
Yes. Can't avoid it.
We always start out kind of comparing the book to the film. They're different in a lot of ways. Now, there's the obvious plot point of birds attacking people. The book is set in Cornwall in England, whereas Hitchcock moves it to Bodega Bay, California, also a place I have visited, and there's some pictures of that on our Facebook page as well. The book centers around one family, the Hawkins, and their attempt to endure. The film is mostly on the Brenner family, with the inclusion of Melanie, of course. There's much more focus there on the townspeople as well. You don't see that in Daphne du Maurier's novel. There's the scene in the film, the death of Dan Fawcett, the farmer with his eyes pecked out, speaking of giving you nightmares. I'm pretty sure that's the one that got me as a child. That kind of parallels when Nat Hawken pulls up into the Trigg family's farm and discovers them. And there are a couple of times the radio is used in the film to gather some information. And that is a huge, huge plot point in the novella. But aside from that, I mean, and we're kind of grasping at straws at a couple of those. That's about the only similarities. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I naturally feel like most film adaptations try to work in a potential love arc. To me, that was the biggest difference in particularly our main characters in the book versus the film. And there wasn't one just super apparent love arc in the book, right? Or in the novella. It was already a set family. We have Nat, he has a wife, two children. But then in the film, we have this potential love story at the very beginning that kind of hooks viewers in.
So were you were you like at the beginning, like, she's really going to drive to Bodega Bay?
Yes, definitely.
It seems so far-fetched because when I visited, you know, I was in San Francisco, and I know what kind of a drive that is. It's not a short drive. It's definitely not something I would do just to go deliver to a stranger. And the first time I saw it, I was kind of like, oh, because they mentioned her being a practical joker. And I'm like, Okay, it's a good joke. But I don't know if I'd go that far out of my way. And, of course, idiot I am, it hit me. Oh, it's not so much she wants to play a joke. She's Rod Taylor, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a Romeo Juliet moment, you know, a love at first sight kind of, I think, play. Because when she went to the apartment, I was like, okay, that makes sense. That's funny, you know. Right. But then she drives an hour and a half. I'm like, to deliver some birds and then rents the boat.
Spoiled little rich girl, I guess, spending daddy's money.
Well, I mean, of course, we're probably going to get into some of the kind of the sort of theoretical reads of the characters in the film. And, you know, through a psychoanalytic level, this could say something about Melanie, that she is this committed to this joke or to this potential love affair that she's willing to do this. So,
and did she jump in that fountain or was she pushed? Do you believe her? She lies so much.
I want to believe her. She has a lot of conviction in her moment of, I was pushed.
I like her. I want to believe her, but she's lied to his face so many times. Who knows?
And I like the love arc in the film. I like that it's not the main focus of the film. It doesn't overshadow the overall horror aspect of it. And I really appreciated that, how understated it was in terms of the entire plot.
And it's completely absent in the book. Well, I mean, he's married.
Right.
But we know there's no romance in marriage, so. I'm joking.
Oh,
I'm joking.
No.
Oh, the hate mail I'm going to get. But speaking of the book, Mackenzie, would you like to go ahead and jump into your close read?
Absolutely. And I would like to mention that I watched this film before I had ever read the story. And I think maybe all three of us, that's the case.
Definitely for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, film first.
So it was a big change in character dynamic for me reading the story after having watched the film. Because I watched the film, so I went into reading the story expecting one thing, one sort of family love dynamic, and then in the book, there is a set family already. And our main character is Nat, instead of in the film, it's really kind of Melanie for a lot of it, of a huge focus on her. No doubt, partially to Hitchcock's fame, there are more pieces of scholarship that mention Daphne du Maurier and Alfred Hitchcock together that discuss the birds. I don't really see a lot of scholarship about the birds on its own, at least not as much as I see it related to the film. And as I take a close read into certain aspects of the story, I wanted to take a different approach and defend the story as a potential gothic read, particularly through the characterization of Nat Hawken. There are three staples of gothicism embodied in the characterization of Nat, And I think that that's unreliability, isolation, and this concept of otherness that we see a lot in Gothicism. Particularly American Gothic, we see the idea of otherness, but also in English and British Gothic, we see this idea of otherness constantly in isolated settings and people. And immediately, Nat is characterized as having, quote, solitary disposition, end quote, despite being a family man with a wife and two children. So this immediately isolates him in some ways, and the reader emotionally feels detached from Nat because he is detached from his surroundings and his emotions. However, even before the mention of his family, he's immediately characterized as a war veteran with a disability resulting from combat. And it's important to note here that this story is referring to World War II, and so some themes of fear and domination relate to that trauma that every nation suffered from World War II. So characterizing Nat through his disability and status as a veteran first and foremost gives this sense of otherness to his character as well. Like he's so different from all other characters we will encounter in the story. Which isn't a lot. Like we talk about in the film, there's a lot of townspeople, a huge focus on community, and in the story, there's a large focus on Nat. Now, I don't really endorse this interpretation of the story. It's not my first thought. However, a potential analysis through the lens of Gothicism could be that Nat speaks about the birds as a metaphor of self-reflection. So, for example, when describing the birds, Nat expresses, quote, make haste, make speed, hurry and begone. Yet where, and to what purpose, end quote. This rhetorical question could mirror Nat's own conflict with who he was before the war and the man that he is now. To what purpose is he working towards? Because after all, the only point of view that we get for the entirety of the story is from Nat himself. So aren't the descriptions and events inherently biased in some ways, if we can only see his point of view? It's also mentioned in the beginning how Nat likes to take many odd jobs that he can do on his own to occupy his time, and he reflects that the birds are, quote, like people whose apprehensiveness of death before their time drive themselves to work or folly. The birds do likewise, end quote. So we see now that Nat relates the birds' formed attacks to his current habits and experiences during World War II. He references the birds as units that resemble air raids, and he even uses words like shelter and territory to describe his town and home. Therefore, one could argue that Nat's trauma contributes to his being a potentially unreliable narrator. Not to mention that the horrors of war and supernatural-like behaviors of the birds demonstrate classic Gothic tropes as well. Again, this wouldn't be my initial or primary analysis, but as a scholar looking at the story through multiple lenses, there is an argument that could be made for describing this text as Gothic. My first instinct would normally be to read this through an eco-critical or even formalist perception with a focus on how the point of view affects the narrative and the message. Because again, I do think that the isolated feeling that this entire story has is because of the use of point of view and narration in Nat's character.
It's interesting you say it wouldn't be your first read, because I've taught this several times in my British Lit Part 2 class, and the very first time I taught it in the Gothic unit alongside Susan Hill's Woman in Black, which might become an episode at one point. And several others, I think a Mary Shelley piece and some other short stories from that time. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's 100%, or it can be read as a Gothic novel.
I love the Gothic. I could interpret almost anything, I think, in in the Gothic, just because it's such a wide, diverse, and emotional, really, lens to look at things through.
Well, there's a great, I think it's Nina Auerbach in Woman and the Demon reads Ridley Scott's Alien as a Gothic film in space, and you can certainly see an argument to be made for that even. But I digress. I'm going to do my close read on a particular scene, and I should have done more due diligence here, but it's somewhere around the hour 40 minute mark to the hour 45 and 11 seconds mark. And what I want to talk about here, that I guess I'll go ahead and say this now. I love this film, I do. Some of you may know my research and scholarship is in animal attack fiction, and which includes both literature and film. And this is a wonderful example of that. Going back and rewatching it, it was not scary, or at least it wasn't as scary as I thought it was. And I realized the reason. It's no fault of Hitchcock. It's the special effects are terrible. It's 1963, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
1963, they just didn't have the kind of special effects. I laughed at them. When the gas station explodes, I'm just like, oh my gosh. Matter of fact, there's a very good Saturday Night Live episode where Kate McKinnon is playing Melanie Daniels in the phone booth. And if you get a chance to watch that, it's worth watching. They kind of make fun of just how bad those special effects are. But then we get to that scene where they board up the house and they're waiting for the next wave to come. And it is like pants-crappingly scary. It's intense, and it really shows you what Hitchcock can do. So I kind of want to look at that and talk about what I think makes that so terrifying. And a lot of it is just simply the camera work. Hitchcock is a master of camera work. Y'all know, if you listen to this podcast, how much I love Dutch angles. It's interesting that Mitch is boarding everything up, and then we zoom in, you know, seeing the whole family sitting around, Melanie and Kathy. And Lydia is sort of perched between the piano and this little alcove, I guess, little half wall that's there. And suddenly the camera hits her in a Dutch angle, just sort of out of nowhere. And that's about the time we start to hear these chirping birds. That Dutch angle is signaling to us, you know, that something's about to go awry. It is interesting, too. We get a lot of low angle shots here. And again, we've talked about those, particularly in I Know What You Did Last Summer. Usually speaking, when you have a low angle shot on a person, it makes that person kind of tower above and seem more imposing. Think about Batman. Batman is never shot when it's not a low angle shot because he's freaking Batman. But here, obviously, these people are being besieged. But to me, and Brenna, you know more about this than I do, but it kind of shows me something's off kilter, right? Something is wrong. And even though we're looking up at them, it did not feel like a typical low angle shot. It almost made them feel more vulnerable, like a high angle shot would.
Yeah, to me that was that moment, I think, when there was a little bit of a lull in the action and they thought maybe they were safe, but of course they knew that they really weren't. And we know, of course, that they're not. So to me, it kind of indicated that the danger was from above, because that low angle, we're looking up at them. They're somewhat like anxious faces, and then we're kind of looking up beyond them, and that's sort of hinting to the future. But you're right. I mean, whenever we violate sort of a formal trope, like, you know, the idea that the low angle does make the protagonist seem kind of mighty, whenever we're violating something like that, we as viewers, because we're so trained to this film language, we know that something is off. So, yeah, even if the characters don't know for sure, we know.
And after the scene, inexplicably, when Melanie goes upstairs, there's a nice high angle shot there that really makes her look vulnerable. And of course, you know Hitchcock and his staircases. He loves those shots with staircases. But back to this scene, of course, the power goes out at one point, which also makes it darker and lends to some of the fear that's there. I want to talk about the sound. And I know Brenna will have a few things to say about this as well. That don't sound like birds to me. That is just fingernails on a chalkboard, kind of just eerie and ugly and unnerving, but it does a great job of making you feel on edge along with those crazy camera angles.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really a bold choice from Hitchcock to use an electronic score. I mean, of course, you know, the traditional score would be, you know, sort of sweeping strings. You know, Bernard Herrmann, of course, had done some really interesting work that kind of violates sort of the soft melodics of many kind of classical scores. I mean, think about Psycho, you know, that in the shower scene. Sorry for the bad imitation of Bernard. But
you didn't see her doing the motion, too.
Yes,
she's stabbing.
Of course I was doing the motion. Yeah. But, I mean, it's a really, really bold... I mean, Hitchcock, one of the things I like for him, even into the 1970s, and this is something I talk about when I did my work on his 1972 film Frenzy, 72-73... is that he continued to experiment right to the end of his career. And this is really an interesting choice. And I had a choice. I had the chance this summer to go actually to a museum in Munich that happened to have the complete workshop for the gentleman who did the sound effect for the birds. And they had his entire studio, including, and I'm going to mispronounce this because I do not, unlike my colleagues, speak German, but it's the Mixture Trautronium. And this was the machine that was used by Oskar Sala to create the sound. And to me, yeah, it's that nail on the chalkboard. Also a little bit like fighting cats. There's something kind of uncanny.
I kept thinking cats
and eerie,
screeching.
And the kind of, every time you hear it, you're kind of like... you know, you just have that slight, like, little piece of trauma. And I think it's also to the uncanny, because it sounds like a bird but doesn't sound like a bird, because it's kind of occupying that kind of uncanny valley orally. There's just something off. And that sound, I mean, I noticed watching the film this time, it starts in the title sequence. So right from the beginning, Hitchcock is building in this weird soundscape, something wicked coming in, you know, under, including, of course, his own title, which he loves to do. He loves to, like, play with the title
Always a
sequence.
Curious, fun, yes. Eye-catching titles.
Yes.
Yeah, and I do, I have to just mention, since we're talking camera angles as well, once it's all over with, you know, the birds kind of subside, we get this shot where he starts with Lydia, and you can kind of see Kathy in the background. And he pulls back, and as he does, we see Melanie, and then we see Mitch, and they're all kind of staged, Mitch being the tallest because he's closest to the camera. It's this beautiful shot of perspective. It kind of reminds us they've made it through it. Our script, I have literally have written in all caps, friggin' amazeballs shot. I don't know where I heard the word amazeballs, but it's incredible. His direction is just amazing.
Yeah.
I do think it's scarier, too, because we don't see the birds. We don't have those horrible special effects, but we do get, like, those points where they're poking through the wood, and that makes it even scarier. It reminded me a lot of a home invasion film, and those in particular, you know, we're talking like Funny Games or The Strangers, The Purge, the very first Purge, of course, is a nice example of that. There's something about those home invasion films that are terrifying because, you know, we have that saying, a person's home is his castle. It's the one place you should feel safe. And I think this is also why haunted house films work as well, because there's no sanctuary in the one spot where you can actually be safe. And, you know, to be reminded of that, to have that onslaught on their house, and to feel like it never gets breached. Well, I guess the attic does in the next scene. But they're safe, barely. He gets a little bloody when... Can the birds open the shutters? That one scene, I kept asking myself. You know, he ties the shutters shut. I guess these are pretty smart birds. They're figuring out how to open shutters too. But
I mean, crows are very, very intelligent.
That is true. Crows have been known to use tools.
Yeah, gulls maybe not so much.
They'll sure fight you for a French fry or something
well,
if you're on the beach.
That's true. Yes, that is true.
At any rate, I just wanted to highlight that scene because, like you, I love Hitchcock. He's got an amazing eye and so visually interesting. I think all the elements came together to just make a perfectly terrifying scene in that one point.
Even with the sound, I love the amount of unnerving silence that is throughout this film.
Mm-hmm.
I love it because I realize now almost every moment of every film, it seems, that comes out nowadays has music filling in the gap in some form or fashion to provoke emotion. And I understand that. But in this film, when there was a moment, I think it was maybe the first moment in Bodega Bay when Melanie was just walking the streets. She was just going to the general store, back to the car, and it was so silent except for her footsteps. And I thought, this is so captivating that it's silent and it's so unnerving. And I loved that.
The general store is now an antique store.
Uh-huh.
And there's a television in there with the birds playing on loop constantly.
Perfect.
Also, there's a telephone booth with a mannequin of a woman in that very dress sitting inside of it and a life-size representation of Alfred Hitchcock on the other side. So, Bodega Bay is a beautiful city. It really, they're not joking in the film when they're talking about it being kind of podunk and nothing there. I mean, I don't think there's a single fast food restaurant. There is a Tides restaurant, which is a tourist trap. But yeah, I think all of their revenue comes strictly from just people coming in to look at the old schoolhouse and the church that's in the background and to see that general store that's now an antique store. Still worth the trip. And you're in wine country, so not to mention I've had some of the best seafood I've ever had in my life at the little restaurant there. So, and there are warnings all over too. Not to leave your food unattended if you're eating outside because of the seagulls, which I always find amusing. Speaking of good places to eat in Bodega Bay, before we swoop back into our discussion, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor, the Tides Restaurant.
One of those days when all your culinary options seem like they're for the birds, nestled in the heart of Bodega Bay, the Tides Restaurant offers more than just breathtaking views and fresh seafood. It's a place where you can savor the local catch while keeping an eye on the skies.
At the Tides, we pride ourselves on the coastal cuisine. Our clam chowder is famous and our fish and chips are to die for. Just don't get too distracted by the feathered friends peeking through the window.
Whether you're a local or just flying in for the weekend, our welcoming atmosphere and picturesque setting make the Tides the perfect spot for a meal. Enjoy the fresh, salty air and perhaps a friendly gull or two dropping by to say hello.
And for those couples out there, we offer our exclusive Lovebird Special. Perfect for a romantic meal or a cozy dinner with a friend, this special includes a delightful seafood platter with a complimentary glass of wine. Just watch out for any peckish birds with an eye on your meal.
So, if you're in the mood for great food, stunning views, and a hint of cinematic history, fly on over to the Tides Restaurant, where every meal is a little bit of heaven and a touch of suspense.
The Tides Restaurant, where your appetite and your curiosity can soar together. Incidentally, we should say this is not the real Tides Restaurant, of course.
It's actually a big
tourist center, and they've got places where you can go buy cheap trinkets. I brought you a postcard back from
Thank
there.
Thank you. Yep.
And the Tides Restaurant is really just a sign that's hanging out that's to mirror the film, and there's some fake birds perched above it. But there's a little restaurant back in the corner, and they serve some very good scallops. I had some of those. So either way, we're not officially endorsing that, of course. Hey, it's time for your favorite segment, isn't it? Most hated character.
Yes, normally it really is.
Normally, yeah. I will say this, and I guess I was just thinking, because I'm so cantankerous. Normally, I can find a most hated character or 12. And, I mean, I had something to say about Brody and Jaws, for crying out loud. This time around, there's nobody I really hate. As far as the people, I mean, Melanie Daniel, you think you'd hate her? Spoiled little rich girl? But it struck me particularly when during the schoolhouse scene, she's running back to protect those children and she pulls them into the car. I'm like, wow, this is not the behavior you expect out of someone who's just spoiled and rich.
Yeah.
Mitch is smug, let's face it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it's to such a point that you hate him. Miss Brenner, Lydia, is set up for you to hate her, but mm-hmm. then we get her backstory and she becomes sympathetic. There is one person, though. It's a minor character. She's credited as hysterical mother and diner. I get that she's scared. Who wouldn't be? But, you know, when Melanie comes back in after being trapped in the phone booth, she starts screaming at her and calling her basically a witch and saying she brought this plague upon Bodega Bay. The word that immediately came to mind was Karen. Like, I'm surprised she wasn't also demanding a free lunch because people talking were scaring her kids. Either way, I guarantee you the shrimp she was eating was overcooked. Promise she was complaining about that.
And, you know, in the text, there are so few characters. And we have no exposure to them outside of Nat's interactions. So I can't say I dislike any character from the original story. If anything, I suppose I am a little bit upset with the Triggs in the story when they laugh off Nat's warnings about the birds. However, if we think about it objectively, unaware that this is a potentially gothic story, then of course their actions seem entirely justified. Of course they're kind of laughing off this guy saying, birds are ganging up on us. You know, I can't necessarily blame them for that.
You know, it's similar to the people in the diner too. That just hit me.
Yeah.
Because there's one guy who's literally like, let's just go get guns and shoot them all. Which is pretty much what Mr. Triggs says, right?
Yes, he's literally found with his like gun in his hands having shot at the birds before his death. And could they have been a little bit more polite about their disbelief? Yes. But I don't dislike them. You know, I don't begrudge them for how they handled the situation. It's just one of those moments where you sigh as a reader and you're like, oh, if only you knew. You know, if only you knew what was going to happen, you'd act so differently.
I think we call that dramatic irony, don't we?
Yes.
It's almost like we have a term for
that. Dramatic irony. And in the film, I agree, the only time I really dislike someone is when that mother suddenly accuses Melanie of being evil and bringing on the bird attacks because, I mean, there's just no way, you know. However, I did see this direction coming because we don't get the information that this is happening all around the country like we do in the original story, which, in mind, you know, makes the story more of a potential eco-criticism read than the film. Because in the film, there is more of that individualized occurrence that makes for more of a postmodernist critique. Just because in the film, it's only happening in Bodega Bay.
Santa Rosa, which is nearby.
In Santa Rosa, yeah. And so when Melanie came and this began, I kind of saw that this would probably happen. But I do appreciate how it happened in that it wasn't, again, a huge overarching plot in the story where everyone was just blaming Melanie for everything. It was brief, it was effective, and while I dislike the mom's attitude a bit, her acting was superb. Her facial acting, I thought, was very well done.
Just wait until the reboot. Please don't reboot this.
Oh, God, no.
You can't touch perfection. It's like covering Stairway to Heaven. Just don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that Lydia, Mrs. Brenner, you're kind of set up to think she's going to be a nice queen. You know, that she's going to be like the horrible mother in films like Notorious, who's really just, who is a Nazi, you know, so... Bad. But no, and I mean, I think part of that's Jessica Tandy.
Miss Daisy.
Yeah,
I didn't even realize it until it hit me.
And she was only in her 50s when she's playing.
She looks 70.
I know.
And when she was 90, she looked 70.
Yeah. No, she's a beautiful, classy lady. I was interested in the way that she and Melanie, you know, are dressed almost identically. Like, they're different colors, you know, and different choices there and different materials, but they are kind of two versions in some ways of the same woman, which I thought was very kind of Oedipal, thinking about Mitch.
They even mentioned Oedipus at one point.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and the whole family dynamic is so interesting.
Well, they say you marry your mother.
Well, yeah, because he refers to his mother repeatedly as dear, which I found... a little strange, maybe a little off-putting. It was just, it was kind of interesting dynamic because, I mean, Tandy wasn't that much older than Taylor. They almost read like a couple as opposed to a mother and a son.
He does look way too old for Melanie.
Yeah.
I did notice that.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's actually very similar to Notorious, the casting Notorious, where the actress who plays the mother of... it's Claude Rains, the character who marries Ingrid Bergman in Notorious, also a Nazi. The Claude Rains character, not the Ingrid Bergman character. But there again, you've got a very young mother in connection with an older son. So there's an interesting kind of, you know, psychoanalytic element. And then Kathy seems so young that she almost, it feels almost like she's, you know, Mitch's child. Mm-hmm. So you get that kind of nuclear family of sort of Melanie, Mitch, and Kathy, but you also get the mother character. And I do find it interesting that at the end, Lydia is really kind of mothering Melanie, like as if she's Kathy. You know, so she's, you don't hear anything about Melanie's mother in the film. Do you recall?
Yes, in the birthday scene, she says her mother ran away and left her.
Oh, okay. I didn't catch that. So that's very, again, very sort of Freudian. So here she's getting not only a lover in Mitch, you know, potential husband, but she's also getting a mother in Lydia.
If she's ever going to be the same.
Yes, that's true.
I guess it's just shock.
Yeah.
She'll probably recover, but
right. She's
a totally different person coming out of that house.
And of course, you know, they didn't, the ending that Hitchcock, I think, or someone, perhaps the screenwriter Evan Hunter had proposed, was that the birds would not just be in Bodega Bay or Santa Rosa, but that they would be in San Francisco too. So there's basically no escape. So that would have been a much more somber ending. So not only Melanie, but potentially all the other characters.
Much more keeping with the original text
as well. Yeah, much more echoing that. But as far as hated characters, no, I would say the woman in the diner. I wrote down a witch, but not the fun Monty Python version. that was just that kind of, you know, that sense almost again kind of that. I mean, I wrote a number of notes, and we may get to this, of kind of feminist criticism and kind of the way in which women are represented. And if we're thinking about Melanie as this potentially kind of dangerous, independent woman who is kind of potentially associated in some ways with the birds or even with the beasts. You know, she's wearing that fur coat repeatedly. I think it is interesting that there is this kind of sense that there is this eruption of this dangerous female presence to which this woman is reacting. But of course, it also reminds you of like the Salem witch trials. That's why.
Are you speaking my language now?
Yeah.
Because in so many animal attacks, the woman is so closely associated with the attacking animal, whether it's, we'll do a little shameless plug here, go back and listen to Jaws, whether it is Ellen in the book, right, wearing the shark's tooth necklace, or, I mean, think about Cujo in the book, at least, when, I forget her name, I want to say it's Kathy, too, I can't remember the mother's name, but she goes crazy at the end because her, again, I'm going to spoil some stuff here, the kid dies in the book. And she starts like fighting the paramedics because she won't accept the fact her son is dead. And of course, she's been bitten by a rabid dog. She bites one of the paramedics and he has to get a rabies shot. So in many ways, she kind of becomes the attacking animal. That's very common. I'm not going to say that all animal attacks are misogynistic, but we do get Mother Nature and the women linked very closely in so many of those films.
Yeah, or just even going back to like Greek mythology where we have, you know, figures like the Harpies, you know, which are part bird and part female. There is this sort of interesting kind of combination, this desire to push together the female and the animal.
The Furies, are, they have snakes, and of course Medusa.
Right, Medusa, yeah. So there's, it's I think, and the costuming kind of, you know, enhances that, not only the fur coat, but the way that the green, to some degrees at least, the O'Donnell of the costume that she wears through so much of the film is similar in color to the lovebirds. Now, the lovebirds, of course, are seen as a benevolent force as opposed to the attacking, dangerous force of most of the birds, but it does kind of align her with sort of the animal from early on. So I think that's an interesting kind of approach.
Let's go there. That's in the notes towards the end, but we didn't get to talk to you about your take on this. The lovebirds are so central.
Yes.
They're what bring her to Bodega Bay, and at the very end, Kathy's like, they didn't do anything wrong. Can we bring them along? And so even as they're driving off, she's sitting in the car holding this cage of lovebirds.
Yeah.
What does that represent? I mean, I'm usually pretty good at going, oh, yeah, this can be a symbol for blah, 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 and if I can't think of something, I can at least BS my way through it. I'm just at a loss here. Is it the Beatles, Love Is All You Need, or...?
Well, I mean, to me, one possible reading is that although the family, you know, has been threatened, although the love of Melanie and Mitch has been threatened, that there is this sense of that they can, you know, that they will survive, right? That the lovebirds are this kind of little oasis of goodness and sort of control within this uncontrollable, dangerous world. On the other hand, it could be speaking to that doomed future, right? That, you know, they may think that they have caged the birds, but you can't cage birds.
Yeah, and that was what I was thinking, too. The birds are caged.
Yeah.
And I remember Hitchcock, one of his famous quotes, and I'm probably going to butcher it, but he said something like, in this film, the birds are free and the people are caged.
Yeah, and the people, of course, are caged. I mean, they've retreated to their car, they've retreated to their houses. The birds have claimed not just the skies, but everything else. So
I think of the telephone booth as sort of like a cage when she's stuck in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, and I thought that was so interesting, being confined to a space that signifies communication, like signifies a literal line, telephone line, to community, to other people, but you're trapped in it. I thought that was really interesting, almost kind of symbolic to the community of Bodega Bay being confined to each other. Like, the only place they can find solace is in each other, and will they turn on each other, or will they look to each other for support? You know, there seems to always be that conflict in films and stories like this. Will we turn against each other, or will we come together?
And if anyone from Gen Z is listening, we'll have to explain what a telephone booth is.
And I feel like we perceive the word love a lot of the time as such a cliche theme to look at. You know, we automatically think, well, of course, that's a theme in there. And it's sometimes difficult to read more deeply into symbols like the lovebirds, because everyone in the film keeps saying, of course they are. Like, they keep saying, of course the birds are fine. Of course this is happening. And we're all really thinking the same thing. But from an eco-criticism perspective, maybe it could mean, you know, if we treat our environment with more love, we would receive affection in return instead of nature's inevitable attack. You know, maybe, because I do think, why are the birds attacking these people? And one of your first thoughts is, well, we're polluting their air, we're polluting their water. Why wouldn't they attack us, really? And so these lovebirds, maybe they also symbolize the love that we're meant to give nature in order to receive that love back. I need
all right.
On it.
Next segment then, Enjoy Teach Scholarship. Brenna, just feel free to jump in on any of these. I'll keep it short with Enjoy. Yeah, I love the film. It's good. I mentioned before, my one drawback rewatching it is just the special effects are so terrible. But again, that's not Hitchcock's fault. The direction he does give it, and particularly for his time, it's you can see the master at work. It's a very good film.
I also very much enjoyed the film. I've always enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I think I've seen it maybe four times. over the last couple years, and I've enjoyed it every time. I thought it was a very classic movie. And then reading the story for the first time, it was a big cognitive shift for me, going from the main character, this love family dynamic, to a war veteran post-World War II story. But I really, really loved the story too, and I love all of the historical context that goes into the story. I really appreciate how Du Maurier's characterization of Nat and how she really relates the actions of the birds to real fears that those veterans, World War II veterans, any war veteran, will have for the rest of their lives, and how fear is often so abstract to those who have never experienced that specific state of fear. Like, if the story were to really have happened, I don't know that I could relate to Melanie, who recounts to me the fears that she felt being attacked by these birds, because I have never experienced that. And so I think the concept of fear itself, I just really, really enjoyed that aspect of both the film and the text. And then as for teaching, I could definitely see how teaching the story and film in tandem would be beneficial for students. There is so much to unpack in both mediums. And it is always interesting to compare and contrast, especially to consider the why behind the contrast. I feel like students love to debate a lot of the times contrast. So I think teaching the story and watching the film maybe at the same time or maybe right after could be really effective. On top of just the timelessness of the narrative, I also feel like teaching the story with such unique narrative structure would show students a different point of view in writing that could open their minds to more diverse interpretation, heighten their analysis skills when reading text or watching films in the future, especially watching films, right? Because a lot of times students don't automatically think, I can watch a film the same way I read a story. And they're like, yes, you can. Same analytical processes, right? And I feel like really with any Hitchcock movie, it's teachable, right? I mean, master.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I have taught the novella 3 times, I believe, now. It's just going to be a mainstay on my syllabus. When I started really in my animal attack fiction, I started kind of looking in and seeing where I could integrate some of those stories into my classes, and this was an obvious fit. Not to get too boring, the way I kind of structure my Brit Lit course is for the first half of the semester, we go chronologically. So we hit Romantics, Victorians, Modernists, Postmodernists, and then a little bit of Contemporary, just to kind of show them. So when they're reading, say, a Victorian poem, they go, okay, I understand the cultural milieu. Boy, I sounded like a professor there, didn't I? but the context culturally that it's created in. And then we go thematically. And I always change the themes up, but I have taught it as a Gothic story. Imagine that. Let's see. One year I taught just the apocalypse. We read like Lord Byron's Darkness, H.G. Wells, a couple of short stories from there. And we put the birds in there as well, because at least in the book, I mean, I get the sense this is it. Humanity's done for. And then the last time around, I taught it as a part of the World War I, World War II lit. So we focused very specifically on the war poets like Siegfried Sassoon, Winfred Owen, and we read Graham Greene's The End of the Affair, which also has a pretty good film, wink, wink, somewhere down the line, perhaps. But we also read The Birds in light of that, because of the mentions of World War II and how it was like the bombings. And it's interesting, too, that we don't get a why in the film. Well, really, neither. But certainly the film is just not at all even interested in why. Some people read it, and this may be a stretch, but read it as an anti-communist piece. Because the birds are all sort of this hive mind. I don't want to mix metaphors. But they're all thinking the same way, sort of like we perceived communists to be, and that outside threat coming into this all-American rural town. Again, it might be a bit of a stretch. I don't know how much I buy that, but it's a reading. It's out there.
I mean, in the story, they do allude to, at one point, the potential of this being an attack, like a post-war attack from... Oh, and I can't remember right now in the story which nation they really accuse of that, but I know that they mention, will America help us? I think it is Russia.
Yeah, and they do say something about America coming to help us.
Yeah, they're like, we hope America will come to help us with the birds. But of course, again, in the story, it's happening everywhere, right? So I guess that fear of maybe one nation sending the birds on attack is dispelled pretty quickly because it's happening to everybody.
I did listen to one video that was talking about the film and the ending of the film, and I think it was the screenwriter Evan Hunter, and I don't know if it was his idea or Hitch's or someone else's, had said that the reason for the bird's attack is basically the sins of the Bodega Bay residents kind of coming back to haunt them. Which I thought was interesting that it's
what
not...
What sins? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
You'd think we'd get a little backstory,
yeah,
right? There'd be something
exactly.
Scandalous.
So I don't think that really works, at least with the film as it is. I think you would have to like revise some elements of that. But I thought that was interesting in contrast to kind of the woman in the diner's sort of idea that it's outside forces, in this case Melanie, you know, kind of coming in and destroying the town, that it's the town itself that is being destroyed by itself. So
that is a very common read in the novel Jaws. Miss Minnie, the post lady, yeah, she's convinced. She says at one point, "We're being punished for our sins."
Gotta have one of them.
There's always one in every town. That does dovetail nicely into the scholarship side of things, particularly that question of why and how it doesn't really matter. In my research, I mostly look at film post World War II, and you see these interesting trends. So right after World War II, of course, we've got the Cold War, the fear of the atomic age, and you have what's known as the atomic creature feature. So Godzilla, the beast of 20,000 fathoms, tarantula, which is about a giant radioactive, you know, swollen up tarantula, them, giant ants. And of course, that mirrors our anxieties about the Cold War and the nuclear bomb. You get a break somewhere around late 1950s, I guess, early 1960s. I don't know. I can't think of an instance in 60 before the birds. When you get to the 70s, you get the revenge of nature films. And Jaws being the most famous, it's kind of an outlier in this. But before Jaws even, you had Frogs, The Night of the Lepus. It's revenge of nature. Nature fighting back because of what humanity's doing. And that makes sense because that same era is when we get the invention of the EPA. You know, that comes around. It's actually Nixon who signs the first Earth Day and the first EPA into law. But we start to suddenly be concerned about the environment. So clearly it mirrors that. And then you have the, I guess, late 90s till today. Really, it's a golden age, if you can call some of the sci-fi stuff golden. But it begins with like Anaconda, Deep Blue Sea, Lake Placid, all tongue-in-cheek, very much kind of slyly nodding to the camera, very meta. The stakes are so low. Yes, people are going to die, but it's all going to be in fun. And those are kind of the three eras that you get post-World War II. The weird thing is The Birds is 63. It just sits out here by itself, you know, just perched alone on a wire. we know how we love bad puns here. And I don't know. I mean, it's interesting that there's no motivation to The Birds, but it's also really hard for me to think, where did this come from? Because it's just such a weird outlier. The only other one I can think of is Arachnophobia, which was 1990. But it is so much like the 97 and on films because it's very tongue-in-cheek, very much a horror comedy. And The Birds is not necessarily revenge of nature, definitely not atomic creature. I don't know. I mean, I have no answer to that. I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah, and the film starts almost as a screwball comedy. So it's such a, I mean, genre-wise, it's so interesting and kind of so unexpected. Yeah, I can't think of anything that's kind of happening around there that's really similar to The Birds, you know, kind of what the genesis is. Except that, you know, Hitchcock in 1960, he does Psycho. And that is such a sort of a break with horror films to that period. I mean, of course, in England, you've got films like Peeping Tom, which is also a really important film, kind of thinking about horror. But yeah, it's almost as if Hitchcock is thinking, what can I do now that's really new and different and experimental? And here comes The Birds. So yeah, excellent.
Yeah, I remember watching it for the first time in that first 5 to 10 minutes. It goes completely differently than what you think in those first few minutes.
And it's so clever. You're right. It's almost like a romantic comedy. You've got that banter and they hate each other, but you know they're going to like each other.
Mm-hmm.
It really does set it up that way.
Yeah, even though, I mean, you know, if you kind of, you've got that eeriness, you've got the sound effects over the title sequence when she is in Union Square in San Francisco on the way to the pet shop.
You get and that Alfred swirl. Hitchcock walks out.
Yeah, you get that swirl of birds, you know. And then, of course, you have the presence of all the animals in the pet shop. Very controlled environment, the kittens in the window, you know, everything neat and clean and orderly and very human controlled. But it's setting us up, of course, for the, you know, the opposite. But yeah, I mean, it's again, very, very experimental just in all these ways, which I think is really interesting. And talking about this makes me want to teach it. I haven't traditionally taught the birds in classes. I've tended to go for 39 steps because that's such an early and important sound Hitchcock. And then my favorites like Notorious, Rear Window, every once in a while I'll sprinkle in Frenzy, though that's, you know, not always the easiest sell for the students because the violence is so overt there.
What's the one you did on Brenna's Movie Club? I've forgotten the name of it now.
Oh, gosh. Did I do Strangers on the Train or did I do Notorious?
No.
Oh, the one about the sweet small town set in Santa Rosa? Shadow of a Doubt.
Shadow of a Doubt, that's
oh,
it.
Oh, with the amazing Joseph Cotten, with that speech Joseph Cotten gives.
That's such a good film.
Oh, that's one of my favorite films. And it's one of, you know, the most interesting films because it's set in a sweet little town, like the sweet little town we live in, and everything seems lovely and neat and orderly. And of course, darkness comes to town. Or is darkness already
there
in the town?
Very David Lynchian,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes.
Before
yeah,
there was
very
a David
blue
Lynch.
Velvet. Yes, indeed. So, yeah, but this discussion has made me think, okay, you need to break out of those Hitchcock's films and teach the birds, because I think that students would find a lot really interesting stuff here through psychoanalytic, feminist theory, formalism.
Ecocriticism, animal studies.
Yeah.
Gothicism.
Yeah. I'm going to throw in the Gothic, definitely. You know, there's a lot here. So thank you guys for encouraging me to revisit the birds.
A lot of my class is going to be influenced by this podcast.
We're all going to find that we're teaching from the podcast.
I mean, we're already doing the research, so
yeah, why not?
Might as well use it more than once.
Absolutely.
Do you have any scholarship you'd like to share in the scholarship segment?
Oh, boy. Well, we've kind of touched on some of the scholarship. I mean, as far as, like, feminist critiques, there's a lot of great feminist critics who have dealt a lot with Hitchcock. Hitchcock is
Laura Mulvey,
rich ground. Yep,
famous.
Laura Mulvey, and, of course, the scene in which Melanie has delivered the lovebirds and then is spying on Mitch to see his reaction, and then he gets his binoculars and trains them on her. And we've got this interplay of gazes is just classic Mulvey. I mean, you know, students out there, you want to do a close reading of a scene using Laura Mulvey's Visual Pleasure Narrative Cinema, which is one of the seminal 1970s feminist texts. Definitely choose that scene. That's a good one for that.
Or you can do Zombie Strippers.
Or Zombie Strippers. The world is your oyster, students. Choose anything.
But you'd have to watch Zombie Strippers.
Indeed. But, I mean, of course, I find, because I am obsessed with film costume right now, I think that's really interesting to think of as far as kind of playing into actually some of the things we've talked about as far as kind of a feminist approach. There's a way in which she is coded as very, very traditionally feminine, as very sort of traditionally feminine, as well as there's a lot of class dynamics to the character, too, because she, of course, is quite wealthy in comparison to the other characters.
That car.
Yeah.
Oh,
is that
beautiful.
An Aston Martin, I think it is?
It might be.
Oh, it's a beautiful car.
And it is gorgeous.
I do think it grew a back seat at the end. I don't remember seeing a back seat until they all got into that car.
And that cloth cover for it, for the convertible cover.
I kept thinking, that's not safe. Those birds will peck
right
through it.
But the whole time?
Infrastructure, bad.
I was wondering the whole time, why is this still a convertible? Like, why? We're an hour in, the birds are on attack.
Yes. Excellent question. There were a number of questions I had. I mean, for trying to read sense into the film, maybe not so much. But I love the idea, though, of her being sort of this classic icon of this very cool, collected, independent femininity through what she wears. But then, of course, that along with her makeup, her hairstyle is degraded as we sort of see the horror, the loss of control. And that's very much played out in the manner in which her clothing is just pecked to pieces.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, too, because she's not planning on staying, and then she stays, and then she has to stay another night. So she's always wearing the same thing.
Yeah.
She's probably getting a little ripe, I guess. But she also bought that ugly nightgown.
Yes, at the general
store. I wondered what you thought about that since you... You know, since you're looking at costume, did that jump out at you? Or
it did. I mean, the nightgown's really interesting because I compared.
I think my grandmother had that.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's something much more. I mean, kind of thinking about some of the Oedipal stuff we've been talking about, thinking about her connection with Lydia, because it's very much something you would imagine Lydia might wear to bed, but not that she, you know, our protagonist would wear to bed. She would be wearing traditionally something much more like. Do you remember the very seminal scene in Rear Window when Lisa Fremont the Grace Kelly character, she pulls out this little tiny attaché case and she has the most divine nightgown in there, and she just pulls it out like a magic trick and then models it for Jeffries, Jimmy Stewart character. And he's not getting the sexiness quite so much, but we're definitely getting the sexiness and wondering what's wrong with Jeff that he's not, you know, it's not till the end of the film he finally seems to get it. But that's sort of what you expect. So he's going kind of against character, and it's showing you perhaps, you know, one, of course, the ways in which she can fit into this family unit. You know, there is this element of kind of the taming of the independent, stylish woman that she becomes, this much more kind of traditional, maybe old-fashioned version of the female form wearing that nightgown. It's also interesting to contrast her with Annie Hayworth, the Suzanne Pleshette character, you know, Mitch's former lover who was not loved by Lydia, that she's wearing much more modern kind of clothing, certainly less sort of showing these signs of wealth and privilege than our character of Melanie. But she's kind of the more modern figure. And it's interesting, you know, kind of thinking about the connection between Lydia and Melanie, and maybe kind of explaining that nightgown, that in some ways Melanie, even though she looks very classy and elegant and cool in that suit, is maybe kind of hearkening back to a more traditional, older form of femininity through her dress.
And I think it is very interesting how complex and contradictory of a character Melanie is.
Yes.
In relation even to the story of Nat's wife, Mrs. Hawken, like, she never even gets a name. We never even get to know her name. And she's the main character's wife, mother of his children. And so I think that's very interesting that in the story, the primary female presence, we don't even get to know her name. She isn't directly involved in a lot of the story. And then in the film, Melanie is, I mean, the first character we see, we get to know. And she is very dynamic in that she says she hates Bodega Bay and then she stays. And she was a wild in her youth, but now she wants to change and become more mature. And so I think her character development is very interesting.
She totally jumped in that
fountain.
She's lying.
And yet, I mean, as much as we see her character developing, there's also a way in which she kind of regresses. Because again, we see her as that kind of childlike, traumatized figure, you know, almost kind of immobile at the end of the film. So there is both a sense that she's matured and changed and developed, but yet a sense also too that maybe that's complicated. Yeah, I think the representations of all the female figures are really interesting, really much more so than the male figures. Mitch is okay. I don't get a lot of layers from him. Yeah. And then I did enjoy the gentleman in the diner who kept saying it's the end of the world.
Yeah.
Yes, that was great.
Might as well get drunk. It's the end of the world.
Yeah. End of the world. End of the world. So, what a happy note. What a happy note to talk about.
Why don't we move on to the WTF moments?
Yes.
Go ahead. I have thoughts, but let's hear what you have to say, Mackenzie.
I wasn't really that surprised or shocked by anything, but I also attribute much of that to this being such an iconic film and story combo for so long. You know, it's talked about a lot, referenced a lot. And so I guess maybe when Melanie, you know, she and Lydia have such an interesting dynamic. It was one of the key points for me in the film that I focused on was thinking about their relationship. And when Melanie just straight up asked Lydia, does it matter if you don't like me? Like, does it matter if you don't like me if I'm going to be with your son? I was just like, oh man, like there's no sugarcoating with this lady. But really that whole scene of her bringing her tea and not really knowing how to act with each other, I guess I wouldn't call it just a shocking moment, but it was a moment I thought and reflected on a lot.
So one thing that bugs me about horror films is when the characters do something just so bleeding stupid that no actual human being would do. I think of the film Beast that recently came out with Idris Elba, where it's not a good film, but he punches a lion in the face, which makes it a great film, just automatically. But at one point, they're running from this lion, and they run into this old abandoned school, and they leave the doors open. And I was in the theater. I wanted to just scream at these idiots. I maybe get why Melanie goes upstairs. I maybe even get why she opens that door to kind of peek in. Why does she step all the way in? And when she does, why does she fall backwards and close the door? And even then,
lay in front of the door.
Yeah. Just
a couple times she opens it and falls right back and closes it. She could have got out of there.
There was a lot of kind of suspect logic in the film. It's again, suspension of disbelief, but yes.
The exploding petrol station, too, is just kind of just like the guy lighting the cigar.
Right, and the fact that everyone's standing at the window, it's like, why does nobody like open the window before then or like peek out the door and like yell at anyone? They're all like at the window talking, but nobody can hear them because they're muffled behind the window.
We have to have an explosion, I guess.
Yeah. But
a young Michael Bay was drooling.
Preparing for his future. I mean, the traditional, you know, WTF, of course, would be the scene of, is it Fred with his eyes pecked out? The gentleman that Lydia visits with the, who had sold her the chicken feed. So, I mean, that is one of the most kind of overt editing moments because we've got the kind of the shot from further away, closer shot, close up to really like pull us into those pecked out dead red eyes. And I mean, that's become so much a trope of horror, you know, that kind of that sort of editing, that kind of shock, that jump scare, that maybe it's lost a lot of its kind of ooh, you know, it's W2F, but it's still, you know, because, of course, I have to confess, listeners, that I am the cowardly person who screamed in John.
Oh, yes, in the first episode.
In the first episode. So I have perhaps, I'm a cowardly custard, so I'm more likely to be afraid of everything. So that's perhaps why that moment caught me, but that's, you know.
No, that is a very scary moment, and... Mm-hmm. Did you notice he doesn't zoom in? He cuts three separate times.
Yeah.
Goes from like the feet to the legs and then to the face.
It's a really interesting choice there. Yeah.
And the eyes are even a focus in the story because Nat continually protects his eyes, which is interesting because, you know, eyes are the window to the soul. We all know.
What Freud would say.
Fair enough. I don't know if we can get Freudian.
No, we won't get Freudian.
But I do think that, you know, eyes being the window to the soul is that cliche symbolic trope that we think of automatically, but even how we see the world, thinking about not even just how the world sees us and how we see each other in the eyes, but how we view the world through our eyes. I don't know, maybe he was protecting his eyes so thoroughly because he still wanted to see the world be rebuilt after World War II. Maybe that's what he was hopeful for. Maybe that was the purpose he found that he was questioning at the beginning. But I thought it was very interesting when I read the story, thinking about that scene with the eyes gouged out, how Nat was protecting his eyes when he was being attacked by the birds.
You know who else had his eyes gouged out? Oedipus.
Yes. Oedipus. Let's go back all the way
in
to
everything.
Great tragedy.
Gosh. Go away, Freud. We don't want you on our podcast.
He's lingering as Freud, as he would.
Geek out moments. I'm going to do one from the book. And again, I'm going to spoil it if you've not read it, so please go read it. And then definitely come back and listen. Don't just turn us off. Mm-hmm. The ending is so brilliantly understated. It's so well done. So if you don't know Nat, they have, what, two cigarettes left, and he's smoking one. He's like, okay, they're going to go to the Trigg farm the next day and sort of raid them for supplies so they can hole up again. And he forgets to get cigarettes when he's there. So he's just like, I'm going to save that last cigarette. And then at the end, we've got the birds poking, and we know they're about to get through. The birds of prey have shown up, and his family's asleep. They're kind of blissfully ignorant of all this, and he just lights that last cigarette. And you know exactly what that means. Well, my students don't have to explain it. But once I explain it, it makes perfect sense, right? It's like, okay, yeah, the world's over. I'm just going to go ahead and enjoy this last smoke.
The light is burning out.
So subtle. So well done.
I agree. I loved it. And we were just discussing earlier before we were recording how endings can let you down so often. But it really is just beautiful.
That would be on my other podcast. Shameless plug.
It really was just so beautifully done. And I don't know if I have just a very hardcore geek out moment, even though I thoroughly enjoyed both the text and the film. However, I do really love the entirety of the scene in the diner when Melanie comes in and is explaining to the locals the attack on the children in the school. I love it because nothing in the diner stops at all. That's really just how life is. I love that the waitress was still taking orders, and even the swishing of the doors was very prominent.
What's that, Bloody Mary?
Yeah, I mean, It was just, I just loved it. From beginning to end, I was focusing on everything happening. And of course, the guy, the end of the world guy, he came in. You always got to have that guy. I love that guy in the films. And so just, I don't know, everything about that scene to me, I just really loved the life that was going on. Even though life was being threatened, it was like life was still happening. I liked that.
Yeah, and I confess, of course, geeking out the costumes. So, I mean, other elements as well, but I couldn't help, you know, just thinking about those wonderful Edith Head costumes for the film. You don't see her in a lot of them because that's part of the point. You know, she's wearing the green suit through all that trauma, but that black suit at the beginning is really interesting, and it's an interesting contrast with the green suit because, of course, that's black and white. She's wearing much higher heels. It's much more very elegant, very San Francisco, incredibly stylish. The green suit is still stylish, but she's wearing brown with it. It's a little bit more down-to-earth. It's a little bit more sort of foreshadowing kind of the more down-to-earth people of Bodega Bay and sort of the world that she's going to be getting into. And, of course, the green and brown are more sort of traditional nature colors. Again, if we're going to kind of connect her with the birds, that connects her again with a little bit with nature. So, yeah, I'm afraid that's what I was geeking out with, but I'm kind of obsessed with costumes at the moment. Occupational hazard.
Yeah. If I had to be stuck in an outfit for 3 days,
yeah,
hers would be my choice.
It is beautiful. Just lower heels.
Yes.
Lower heels.
Oh,
and
definitely.
And maybe the bag from Harry Potter with everything in it, you know. So
yes,
the handbag that contains like your own apartment.
I did think that was very interesting when they went to, what were they doing right now? Mitch and Melanie were on their way to get Kathy from Annie's. And when they get her, one of the first things Mitch does is take her bag so she can take Kathy and then hands her back the bag. And I'm like, why didn't you leave it in the car? Like, I was wondering, this bag must be very important because they just... they're sidestepping the bag the entire time they're trying to save this little girl's life. So I just thought that was very interesting that the purse was priority.
Must be an expensive handbag.
Yeah.
Kate Spade or something.
Hermes.
We've shared a lot.
Yeah, we have.
I don't know that I have any final
thoughts. We did our final thoughts.
There is one final thought. I do love the scene where Melanie goes to the schoolhouse and Annie says, you know, just wait a minute. And she's sitting there and we keep cutting and we see more and more birds.
Yes.
What is up with that song the children are singing?
Forever?
On and on. And it's just the same chorus over and over. And I'm just sitting there like, when is this going to end? It had a, maybe this is a sonic thing as well. It was very uncanny to me. And children singing anyway can be creepy if you put it in a minor key or just acknowledge that children are creepy in general. But I don't know. It grated on my nerves towards the end. I'm like, please, something happen.
Yes, that song is, again, kind of uncanny. And I was meant to look it up.
You know, I read the lyrics. I forgot what they were.
Yeah, I mean, I thought at first, well, maybe it's like an old folk song, like one of those ones that seem like really sweet, like London Bridge is Falling Down or Ring Around a Posy, but are actually really sinister when you understand the context. But no, I think it was a folk song, but not necessarily an old folk song and sung by a folk singer kind of the period. But yeah, because Melanie...
Wee Cooper of Fife. According to the internet, which is always correct.
Always correct, yes. But yeah, because Melanie keeps looking and waiting and waiting, and we sense her anxiety, and of course, what we know, but she doesn't know because she's not getting the nice shots of them, is that the birds are slowly more and more and more birds. And to me, that's like the best special effect. Like the special effects, I agree with Stephen that they are unfortunate, but just simply the use of the birds combined with editing, cinematography, performance, can be incredibly, incredibly frightening.
The butter came out a grizzly gray, ristlety, rosslety, now, now, now. The cheese took legs and ran away, ristlety, rosslety, hey, Donny, docilty.
We have to sing it.
Nickety knack, retro quo, quality, willity, wobbly, now, now, now.
Maybe.
That's just the first verse.
Teaching pronunciation, maybe?
I have no idea.
It's a mystery, but definitely, just like the sound of the birds, it's something uncanny and unpleasant. So,
any final thoughts from you?
Just that this has been really fun. And again, I have a renewed appreciation for the birds. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things with Hitchcock, is that there are so many layers and you can discover so many things just watching again and again. And then, of course, watching more films in the, you know, in the oof, and then kind of coming back and sort of seeing the connections between them. But yes. And I love birds, but I'm not going to refuse to go out in nature like Janet Leigh famously refused to shower ever again after Psycho. But I am going to be looking at, you know, my cardinals, my sweet little mourning doves, a little bit more anxiously.
Wondering.
Well, chickens were your best friend, right?
They were, yes.
Read her book of Moose and Me. It's very good.
I do love our feathered friends. Yeah, this film may make me slightly more of a critical reader of them.
Well, first of all, thank you so much to our lovely colleague Brenna for coming by and sharing your insights. I know our listeners were compelled and learned so much.
This has been such a pleasure being on the podcast. It's really fun to talk with you guys. I mean, we get to talk about film often, but not for an extended period like this. And this is really fun to share this.
This is every brunch on Saturday, actually.
Yeah, pretty much. But no, and thank you so much for inviting me and letting me revisit the birds.
Oh, no, thank you. I know I learned so much.
Oh, thank you.
And all three of us have day jobs that keep us behind the podium in university classrooms, so we're all keenly aware of what's coming up in a couple of weeks. Our next episode is very fitting. We follow the antics of creative writing professor Grady Tripp as he navigates his hectic life during the Visiting WordFest event at his university. From nagging editors to prize pupils to stolen cars, we're going to take a trip to Pittsburgh with the Michael Chabon 1995 novel and the 2000 Curtis Hanson film Wonder Boys. I used to care, but things have changed.
Whatever platform you're using to listen, please do us a favor and tap that follow button so you can be notified whenever a new episode drops. And if you enjoy the show, consider leaving us a rating. Don't forget to check out Steven's solo podcast, Shelf Criticism, where each week he selects a DVD from his massive collection and gives it a critical look. You just released an episode last night, right?
Yeah, that's right.
The Jean-Pierre Jeunet film, A Very Long Engagement?
Yes, absolutely. I love that film.
And what's next up?
Next, not as good of a film. The Red Rings of Fear. And yes, it's every bit as poorly executed and schlocky as it sounds.
Oh, I'm sure you're going to have a really great episode over it, though.
I got through watching it once, but now I've got to watch it again. I don't know why I put myself through this.
In the name of scholarship. Mm-hmm. Well, you can find Steven's solo podcast at shelfcriticism.com. If you liked what you heard, please join our social media community. You can find us on Facebook by searching Real Lit Podcast, on Instagram at Real Lit Podcast, and on our official website, reallitpodcast.com. Remember, that's real, R-E-E-L, like a film reel. Real Lit is an Owls of Palace production. Our executive producer is Reagan Babb. Our theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Ahala. For Real Lit, we're your hosts, Mackenzie and Steven. Until next time, keep both the reels and the pages turning.